slots here for each group. You put their names and their topic on the top there. You don't have to put your name on this one, okay? And what all I want you to do is kind of go along the continuum, okay, where you think it is. Excellent, so I don't need an absolute. I'd also like a comment or two underneath it, you know, clear, not clear, you know, should have tightened up their experiment or something like that, okay, underneath there. So you have the first little box for each group is presentation. Okay, so that means just the presentation now. Okay, did they do a good job, keep you awake, that kind of thing. The second part, did this relate to anything you heard about in this class? Okay, if not, then it goes to the end of reasonable there. Huh? If it does and you feel it was, you know, well, look at, I spent comments wrong on the second one. Then, huh? Okay, and the last one is task and project assessment. It doesn't mean the task has to be all right, okay? It means that they are also, if it didn't go all right, they gave you a nice reason why it didn't, okay? So we're not looking for, wow, what? Look at this research, what I found. We're looking for, look at this research, I didn't find something, and but I recognized it, or I know what I might do next time or try to do next time. Okay, so is there any question about this? Now, at the end of class, if you're irresponsible, you please hand it in to me and I will hand it back to you next week, okay? If you're responsible, you keep it and bring it, keep bringing it back each week, okay? Whatever you want. I'm joking about whether you're responsible. Smile, okay? But if you don't, if you feel nervous about losing it, please give it to me today and we'll just keep this in the blue things and we'll get it back next week, so. Okay, are we ready? Did you check with the videotaping with everybody?
I didn't bring the video recorder, so.
So what are you doing?
That tape. That recording.
Oh, but did you ask them?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Great.
So you guys can put our names on the sheet. My name's Kara.
I'm Haysom. H-Y-E-S-E-U-N-G.
I'm Sandra.
Okay, I'm sorry. One other thing. When you're almost 30 minutes, I'm going to tell you, okay? You finish, okay? Don't just stop at that point, but you know you have to stop.
Well, through this class, we all know that there are there are many kinds of speech acts, such as requests, complaints, disagreements, apologies, corrections, and refusals. And what we're going to do today is about refusals. And just to let you know what kind of studies there have been till now, I think there hasn't been a lot of studies on refusals, which is, I don't know why, but maybe it's because it's such a complex area. But anyway, I found two studies that are quite related to what we're going to do today, and one of them is by Bibi Takahashi and Ulis Welts, and it was done in 1990. And they compared Japanese and American refusal strategies in order to present evidence of pragmatic transfer in Japanese ESL learners' refusals. And the result was that they had evidence of transfer in both Japanese and American. They found evidence of transfer. And what they found was that both Japanese and Americans favored the strategy of using an excuse and showed a tendency to begin their refusal with refusal of junk such as positive opinion. And the second one is, the second study is by Chui, I think he's Chinese, and he did a study on English refusal strategies in business situations, and it was based on mainland Chinese and Taiwanese ESL learners and native speakers of American English. And the results were similar to the former study by B.B. Takashi and Ulis Wells. And excuse was the most frequently employed strategy by all three groups. And all three groups preferred specific excuses, but both Chinese groups were more family-oriented when making excuses. So that's the studies that have been done on refusals.
And for our hypothesis, we took as a starting point the BB study, which was actually mentioned in our book. And it's on page 185, but I'll just read what his bottom line was. He was studying, as she said, semantic formulas, for examples, excuses, expressions of regret, apologies. We've redefined those terms a little bit, and in a few minutes we'll show you what terms we came up with. His conclusion, though, was that the range of formulas that are available is the same for all speakers. The difference is that the order of the formulas is different between non-native speakers and native speakers. So we weren't very convinced about that, so we decided to test a different hypothesis, which is that in our situation, which was refusing an invitation, the range of formulas that are actually available to non-native speakers is much more limited than the range of formulas available to native speakers, with the consequence that non-native speakers will frequently respond inappropriately in status-governed interactions. When we discuss the task, you'll see that we were controlling for status in the two tasks that we used.
I'm going to tell you a little bit about the population that we studied. We had 10 native speakers, which they were all undergraduate students here at the University of Michigan. And then we had 7 non-native speakers, 2 of which were Korean, 2 of which were Spanish, and 3 of which were Chinese. And among them, they had all been in the U.S. between 3 months and a year, approximately. And it was a mixture of graduate and undergraduate students. And they were all between the ages of 20 and 30, and we also had a mixture of males and females.
Very light print, so you don't have to read it.
Okay. the other light.
Okay, what we did was send out emails. Okay, what we did was we sent out emails to the Native American English speakers and the non-native speakers because we thought that it would make a more natural setting and they won't be pressured to response in the way they should response, and we thought it'd be better than tape recording them. And this is what we sent out. We had two scenarios, and one goes, your professor makes a point of periodically inviting four or five students out to lunch in order to get to know her students better. You receive an email asking you to attend a lunch next week, but you really don't want to go. How would you respond to this email? And the second one is a classmate of yours sends you an email inviting you out for lunch next week, but you don't want to go. How would you respond to this email? So we sent this out, and we got the responses. And what we did is, we didn't send the both two scenarios to all of them. We sent both of the scenarios to the native speakers, but to the non-native speakers, we divided into three groups, and to two of them we sent only the one that concerns the professor, and to two of them we sent the one that concerns the classmate, and the other one, the rest of them, we sent both of the scenarios. And that was because Professor Madden said that if we send two of them to all of them, they would be aware about the status differences, and they would kind of respond in the way they should respond. So we did that, but, well, later you'll know, but it didn't really work out that way. But anyway, we did it. And after we got the response, we tried to make a chart we tried to categorize the responses, and we made six categories. First, you see there are six categories, and the first one is acceptance, and we define it as accepting the offer even though you don't want to, and justification, which is citing a specific obligation that precludes accepting the invitation, and excuse, giving a vague reason or reasons for not accepting. For example, sorry, I'm busy. And concession, which is saying it's not possible for you to accept the invitation without offering an explanation or reason, or expressing an interest in meeting at some future time. For example, I can't make it, or I can't make it, but why don't we meet some other time? And the next one is avoidance. Not responding to the invitation or delaying response. And the last one is refusal, direct rejection of the invitation, citing lack of interest. For example, I don't want to go. So it's kind of confusing, I guess, because it was confusing for us. So we'll...
the bottom one comes out. I mean, maybe if we...
here are the actual email responses we got, and we picked out some of the good examples that represent each of the categories. And for acceptance, this person says, I would definitely go even if I didn't want to. Various reasons, blah, blah, blah. One good suck-up opportunity, two free meal, three good opportunity to re-gear up the professor. In conclusion, I feel that anyone that would not go would have to be extremely unattentive to the opportunities that this meal would present. So this is the best, this was a good example of acceptance. And the second one is justification. I received your message about lunch next week. I would really like to go and meet with you and the other classmates, but my class schedule just does not allow me to be able to make it. I have class that Tuesday from 11 to 1. However, I really appreciate the invitation, and hopefully I could make a get-together at another future date. So
are
this
native speaker responses or non-native?
There's a mix.
So all you're doing here is picking out.
Yeah, just an example to
the most clear that, yeah.
To clarify that you have an idea. So this person has a specific reason to justify his unattendance, and for excuse. Dear Jane, thanks so much for the invite. Lunch would sound great, but I am super busy that week and I have two exams and a paper and I need to go to the accounting office hours and get extra help. I am getting a C, so needless to say, things will be pretty hectic. Thanks for asking, though. Have a nice weekend. So this person just babbles about like what she has to do that week or whatever, but it's not really specific as the one before, like the justification. She said, I have class on Tuesday from 11 to 1, but this person is just generally just narrating excuses. Next one is concession. This one's by a non-native speaker. Hi, how's your plan going on? I wish you good luck with your companion, but I just want to let you know that I will be unable to participate your picnic. I feel sorry, and I hope you have a great time. We may see next class on Monday. Bye. So this one, he lets us know that he can't attend, but he doesn't have a specific excuse or justification. And the last one is avoidance. And this person says, I say I probably wouldn't respond. So that's point, he wouldn't respond. That's what the point is.
I just wanted to clarify that when we began, we didn't anticipate all of these categories. We didn't anticipate acceptance. The email was worded. It didn't say that they had to refuse. It just said, you don't want to go. So we did have some people accept for varying reasons. We didn't anticipate avoidance, which later surprised us because it's a pretty common tactic. Just, I never got your email sort of thing. And we had expected to see some straight refusals from non-native speakers, thinking that limited language or pragmatic knowledge might lead them to be more blunt. But we didn't have that result. So there were two things we got that we didn't expect, and one thing we expected that we didn't.
Okay, now we're going to talk about the results a little bit of what we ended up seeing. Back to the overhead.
Bottom
is
clear, isn't it?
Make it smaller, but This one? Yeah, I will bring, for the others,
great.
I'll bring the overhead from, I think you can almost see it.
Okay.
Yeah, oh. Well, they're locked. But I'll bring the logistics one.
Most people give a justification because pragmatically when you respond to a professor, you wouldn't tell them, I'm busy, I can't make it, or I have so much homework to do. You have to have a specific reason, I'm busy at this time, so I can't be there. So we expected that to happen. And then with the classmate, we expected more excuses that possibly you might justify your reasons, but a lot of the times you can come up with excuses, I'm busy, my mom's going to be in town, something silly, you know, I just can't be there. And so we had 100% for the professor justification or actually acceptance, which is what we didn't expect. So that's even stronger. They're not even going to justify the reasons. They're going to go anyways. So we had very strong results on that. And then for the non-native speakers, we weren't quite sure what we were going to see with that, but we expected it to be a little bit more mixed up. And which is exactly what we got. We got a lot of excuses for the professor, which we thought was interesting, and definitely excuses for the classmate as well. The most interesting result is when you look at the actual percentages that people use. That's For the native speakers, there was 69% justifications overall, and only 27% for the non-native speakers. And then at the other end, the excuses, the non-native speakers had 73%, whereas the native speakers only used 15%. So on the whole, the native speakers definitely justified why they can't be there more often than the non-native speakers did. And then, I think the most interesting fact is that for the professor, we used 83% justifications, and if it wasn't a justification, they accepted. But for the non-native speakers, they only used 40%. No one accepted, no one avoided, and the majority just used excuses, which I thought was very interesting. And then as far as what really supported our hypothesis, I think, was that we expected the native speakers to have a wider range of use of their pragmatic knowledge and have more types of responses available to them than the non-native speakers. And as we can see, the people who did come in with different types of responses were the native speakers, and none of the non-native speakers thought to even accept it or avoid it. They basically had, you know, three types of responses that they could draw from, whereas the native speakers have a much wider range.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
I don't think so.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Are the percentages, can you just explain the percentages?
Sure.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to clarify that actually you didn't think of is they don't add up to 100%. A lot of the speakers, as you can see from this, used more than one type. So like this person is double counted, they used a justification and a concession. So out of these six people, they're counted twice, so they don't all add up to 100%. So what they actually mean is that of all the native speakers who responded to the professor email, 83% of them used a justification in their response. And then the same with each. Is that better?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Anything else?
I'm finished, or?
No. I'm just finished with my bag.
Okay, you can link that on, actually.
Oh, okay. Great.
I'll try to grab one of those things.
try to be quick because I realize we're getting near the time. We just wanted to provide two examples of things that might point out areas for future research for different projects. Let's do this. This response from a non-native speaker to a friend says, "I'm sorry I cannot make it. I think it would be good to have lunch with you. However, the time is not available for me." We couldn't decide if this phrase was an excuse, "I'm not available," or a justification, "I'm busy at that time." So we thought it was interesting that we had an example where linguistic knowledge overlaps with pragmatic knowledge. We think that would be something very interesting to investigate in the future. Another interesting thing was this excuse. This person responded the same way to the professor and to the classmate by saying, "I have a diarrhea these days, so I have a special diet of my own." Now, I don't know. You might consider that a... Most people probably won't ask for any more information, but we felt that the content of this justification was pragmatically inappropriate, at least with the professor.
It was a non-native speaker.
Yeah.
Well, but the thing is, I mean, she's Korean, and I don't think even if she was responding to a Korean professor and a friend, I wouldn't use an excuse like this. I mean, it's really embarrassing to tell anybody that I have diarrhea. And well, I was trying to get hold of her and ask why she had such a response, but I couldn't contact her, so. It just remains a mystery.
It is good, though. It's great to sort of, you know, pick up on something like that. Do you know her? Is she a joker?
Yeah, and the thing is, she does have diarrhea very often.
So she had a plan for next week.
This poor woman.
We've edited out all the names in the email. Okay. So we just thought that, those two things. We didn't take into consideration the content as much or the overlapping of pragmatic and linguistic knowledge, but we thought that those were possible directions for future research. Just briefly, to relate this to current SLA research, especially in the Casper and the Bardovi, Harlig, and Hartford articles, they were saying that there hasn't been that much done on pragmatics. Most of it is focused on use, which is what we had to do given the limited time frame for our experiment. What was interesting, though, is that they were focusing a lot, research has been focusing a lot on politeness markers and status-preserving strategies. And we think that our research might show that not only linguistic form, but the actual semantic formula itself may be a status-preserving strategy. For example, the fact that a justification saying that giving a specific time conflict to a professor would be considered a valid excuse, whereas a vague excuse or saying I have a hockey game would not be appropriate. So it's not only the politeness markers such as I'm sorry, please forgive me, it's also whether they choose a justification or an excuse. And our research showed that a lot of non-native speakers used excuses in all situations. And that is a little similar to the research on the rejections of suggestions made by non-native speakers in the academic advising session. A lot of their suggestions were rejected because they didn't use the correct justification or the correct reasoning for their rejections. So we see an overlap there, given what is considered by the interlocutor to be an acceptable rationalization. That's in relation to the status. The same explanation isn't valid for both your friend and for your professor.
Okay. Well, if we were to do this experiment again, we have a couple things that we would change. The first thing that we would make different is that the letter format itself, we had some problems with that. We tried to make it clear that we wanted them to respond as if they were responding to a professor and not tell us how they would respond, but a lot of people did that. If I were to respond to this, I would tell them this.
instead of just saying, I can't make it or whatnot. So we thought one thing that we would change is we would make it a specific date and time and say that you don't want to go or you can't make it. We would say, dear so-and-so, blah, 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 this time, this day, sincerely, your friend or your professor, instead of saying, please respond if you had received it. So that's one thing we would have changed. And then the other thing we would have changed is we would have ended up sending the scenario to both, or both scenarios to everyone. The reason that we did that, as Hisung said in the first place, was we were afraid that people would see what we were doing. They would see, oh, here's a professor, here's a classmate, I'm supposed to do a different response here, instead of controlling for that variable. But we ended up, two people, I believe, responded that they would say the same thing to the professor and the classmate. They said, this is what I would say either way, and no one seemed to catch on to what we were doing, so we might as well send both scenarios to everyone and have more data.
Sure. Did you get native speakers saying that they would respond the same way?
Yeah.
It was one native and one non-native.
One native and one non-native, which was actually, yeah, very surprising. But the person who said that she would say the same thing to both, actually, she was the one that lied, right?
Oh, Allison. Okay.
Yeah, she said that she would wait, she would say she would go up until the last day, and then she would email and say some plans came up. And so that was the avoidance. That was one of the people who avoided responding, or avoided rejecting someone. So, yeah, that was interesting. Anything else?
Did you find a difference between males and females?
No, we didn't. That's one thing that we did, we controlled for in the beginning. We separated the males and females, and we found that there was no difference, really, very negligible. So,
did you look at all at the amount of time they had spent in the States and what kind of responses they used?
Yeah, that was in the population. Everyone had been here about 3 months to a year, so they are all basically in the beginning of learning pragmatics. No one was extremely advanced. So that was basically controlled for.
Do you think that the appropriacy or inappropriacy of responses, or basically just how the candidates responded, do you think that was due to a lack of pragmatic knowledge, or do you think it was more maybe due to a lack of language knowledge? Like let's say they wanted to make a justification, but they didn't have all the vocab down, so they went with what they could say with vocab they did have.
Well, we talked about that a little bit, didn't we? And I think we decided that it didn't constrain.
Yeah, because I was saying with my Spanish, I don't know much Spanish, but I could just as easily say I have plans from 11 to 1 so I can't be there, as I could say I'm really busy this week. They're both simple sentences. It's just a matter of stating this time is busy for me, or I'm just busy all week. So, yeah, we considered that.
Okay. How do you think your results would have changed if this was a spoken situation?
Spoken situation. It's interesting because a lot of the research that was done has actually been on speaking, and they focus, that's where the bulge theory comes, that there is a lot more negotiation between people that don't know each other very well. That's it. So if the status is unclear, it takes several conversational turns before you get anywhere. So partially because of the scope of the study, we chose to do it as a written thing, so we wouldn't have all that variation.
I mean, do you think they would have been more limited in their responses than on the speakers if it would have been a spoken situation? Do they have to come up a little bit quicker?
That would be interesting to see. My reaction would be,
That's a very good point. Although it is still interesting, even in that modality that you used, you got a real limited scope of the kind of answer, or more limited, not real limited, but so you might get more limitation on that, but it is an interesting question. And even that issue of sending something, someone else in the ELI just did a task where she wanted the students to write down what they would say. It's so difficult for all of us, not just non-native speakers, but you know, to get into that mode and really just do it that way, it's a very difficult task to do.
That's a
initially one reason why we chose email, because we thought it was a naturalistic situation. You really might get an invitation. You really might respond through writing. But I think, as Kara mentioned, we perhaps should have directly just given the letter.
Okay, I think it's very nice.
Names are here. If you can, it's Lucia, Sarah, and Myrna, and the use of closures by native speakers and non-native speakers, and we're trying to say how are they alike or different. Our project design, basically, we collected data on the pragmatic element of closures, the end of conversation, and the task was to complete the questionnaire that you have in front of you. And we were wondering, well, we wanted you to complete it maybe in 3 minutes, try to go through it and see what would you answer and some of the questions. And before you start, from Professor Madden this side, do the third and fourth question first, and you guys can do it in the order that it was given. Thank you.
you guys didn't finish it.
Yeah, just so you have an idea of how we wanted to go through the exercise, so you had an idea of what we got. And maybe you can compare it to what your answers were. 8 native speakers and 8 non-native speakers. And the non-native speakers were students at the ELI from a pronunciation class that the teacher thought they were advanced. They've been here less than a year. But in their questionnaires, most of them marked intermediate. There was 2 Cantonese, 2 Japanese, 1 Thai, 1 German, 1 Russian, and 1 Chinese. So pretty good variety of languages. What we used to design the questionnaire was I called it a framework, and it's one of the Hardovy and Harley, hard for and a lot of people thing, and their focus was more on guidelines and examples for pragmatic lessons on the use of closing in American English. So it was more for teaching of pragmatics, but for that they provided a description of closings that had been previously identified by other researchers, and those were the forms that we used for the questionnaires. And the forms of questionnaire templates were the following. In your first question, answer A is what they identified as a terminal exchange. It's just 2 little short by and the other person by. The form 2, which has a pre-closing and a terminal exchange, is your answer C. So there's actually a little pre-closing first, a little by, see you later, and then another okay, bye. And then form 3 will be your B answer in the first page. And in the middle, there's like an arrangement component. It gives you the pre-closing, and then there's an arrangement that's kind of trying to summarize what the conversation was about or what was going on before, and then an actual close. And then the most complicated one, which is shutting down the topic, is answer D. And once again, they're kind of summarizing what happened before, and then there's actually 2 pre-closing, a closing, and a terminal exchange. So what we were hoping for, and what they said in their paper, was that some cultures have minimal or no closing requirements, while in others, like American English, have fairly elaborate ones, and that the closings are related to the context of the conversation and the context of the situation. And for that, you want to go over?
Sure. So from this basic knowledge we got from their paper, we hypothesized that for question number 1, the first page, we would expect more native speakers to choose closing form 4, which is D on your questionnaire, more often than non-native speakers. So what we actually found was that native speakers compared to non-native speakers did choose form 4 more frequently than non-native speakers. 25% of them did. And then the other 5 or 62% chose form 1, which is answer A. Now, because we expected that more native speakers would choose form 4, an explanation as to possibly why they didn't is because of the instructions. It says you're saying goodbye to a close friend on the telephone. So native speakers might assume because it is a close friend that they probably often see them in person enough, whereas it's not necessary to actually make lunch arrangements or set aside a special time to see them because close friend, you know, we probably talk often, and they might have class with them or something like that. So that could be an explanation as to why more native speakers chose form 4, the elaborate terminal exchange, making arrangements to, you know, pre-closings. And as to a reason why they chose form 1, which is like a very short one, just a goodbye, because they're like, okay, you know, I've seen class, bye. What was interesting was that the non-native speakers, who we expected would choose forms 1 and 2, because they would not have this pragmatic knowledge that English is, you know, very elaborate in closure systems. We thought they would choose form one and two, but they chose it split evenly between form one and three, which is the one being the just goodbye, goodbye, and then form three being having the terminal, the pre-closing, the arrangement, and the terminal exchange. Perhaps it's just, perhaps they picked the shorter forms is because in their native language, perhaps they picked these forms because their native language would maybe have a shorter closure ritual also, or they may also just have been here enough to realize that, you know, they might also have realized that they see these close friends in class or something like that. So that was a bit of a surprise. But to support our hypothesis, more native speakers did choose form four.
And
that's
your,
yeah?
You had 1, 3, 2, but you had A, B, C, D.
Right, these are the answers on the questionnaire, answer A, B, C, and D for question number one. So if you look at your questionnaire, answer A corresponds to form one of the Bardowy Harlan article. Yeah, it gets a little confusing. And form B of that.
Yeah, we mix them up because then you will have 2 lines, 3 lines, 4 lines, and we thought they may kind of be given out the answers.
Okay. As for question number two, that's the waitress question. Our hypothesis was. Our hypothesis was that we would expect expect more native speakers to prefer the closing form 2 and 3 more often than non-native speakers. And form 2 and 3, 2 is answering D on your questionnaire, and form 3 is answer A on your questionnaire. What we found was that 63% or 62% there of native speakers chose form 2, and 25% of the native speakers chose form 3, as was expected. The one native speaker who chose form 4 does that type of stuff in restaurants. I know her, and she's very friendly, very outgoing, just likes to make friends with everybody. Now, what was the surprising factor was that the non-native speakers also picked forms 2, 2, and 3 as often as the native speakers. Whereas, you know, supporting the article, we would expect them to pick the shorter exchanges, such as form 1 and 2. Whereas they did pick form 2, but none of the non-native speakers picked form 1. An explanation as to why the non-native speakers might have also chosen the same forms as the native speakers would be perhaps the tested group of non-native speakers had a clearer understanding of this particular pragmatic context. Perhaps here in Ann Arbor, there's an opportunity to dine out more frequently, and as students, they, you know, go to coffee shops and go to area diners and have more experience in that pragmatic world. Yes, and that's it for question 1 and 2. So, there you go. Answer questions 3 and 4. Well, actually, I just want to get a show of hands. How many of all of you picked form? How many native speakers of English picked answer number A for question number 1? Nobody? Okay, who picked answer A, or answer B for question number 1? Okay, who picked C? Okay, who picked D? Native speakers, 1. Okay, and what about non-native speakers? Who picked answer A? B? C? D? Okay, so B. From this distribution of hands, it looks like it follows almost the same.
Except this one, they just speakers.
Yeah.
Because no one picked A, right? Native speakers?
Mm-hmm.
He did.
Oh,
one person. All right. Okay, for question.
questions 3 and 4, we tried to set up a context that both native speakers and non-native speakers would be familiar with. For question 3, we talked about meeting with a professor for office hours, and for question 4, it was about saying goodbye when a friend is leaving at the airport. And for question 3, we tried to find some generalizations about some of the ways that native speakers and non-native speakers close. For non-native speakers, it was a lot more common for them to avoid the closing. Like, the professor would say, well, if it'll just take a few minutes, then we can do it now. So then they never even had to say goodbye or deal with that at all. CU seems to be pretty universal. Native speakers and non-native speakers alike use that one a lot. See you, see you later, see you tomorrow. But only the native speakers use see you tomorrow. They were more specific about time in general, like 3 of the native speakers said I'll see you at 1 o'clock, set a specific time for the meeting. Thank you and okay were basically only used by native speakers. I'm not sure why non-native speakers weren't as familiar with those expressions. For question 4, our hypothesis would be to expect a dialogue of the form 4 and that it will be produced more often by the native speakers than by the non-native speakers. And we definitely found that to be true. This chart right here, you can see that the native speakers used form 4 50% of the time, which made sense because this was with a close friend who's living at the airport. You would expect it to be a longer dialogue where they're talking and saying goodbye for a longer period of time. Although native speakers did, in a couple cases, use the shorter forms. But those were a lot more common with the non-native speakers. We don't know if it's just because it doesn't seem like a cultural thing. It seems like in most cultures you would have a long goodbye with a close friend. So we figured it was just more simple for them to have a shorter closing when they were writing that. And a couple other things we found were up here that the native speakers used a lot more nonverbal. When they were writing it down, they would use exclamation marks or underlining for emphasis. Or they would allude to physical contact. Like in parentheses, it would say they hug, they wave, they kiss goodbye. And the non-native speakers, as would be expected, concentrated on the verbal. Probably that's as much as, you know, they could handle. They didn't want to go into further non-verbal things. This was something interesting we found, was that in a couple cases, the non-native speakers, and in one case, the native speaker, instead of writing a dialogue format, as we had asked in the instructions, wrote in a narrative format, like only one person spoke. It was just a couple lines of one person speaking. But this only happened in cases where they answered the open-ended before the multiple choice. When the multiple choice occurred first, they would always use dialogue because it's like they had an example beforehand. When they read the multiple choice, it's like, here's some examples of dialogues, and they kind of followed that when they wrote the open-ended question.
That's what the OMMO stands for.
Yeah, open-ended multiple choice. That's why we had half of you do it in one order and half of you in the other. We're going to read a couple examples of what they wrote for the open-ended questions. I'm going to read non-native speakers, one case of Form 1, the simplest form, and one case of Form 4. For the Form 1, it was very simple. It says, me, have a good time. Then the friend who's leaving just said, thanks. It was very simple. That's all they wrote. But then for a Form 4, the writer says, bon voyage, which is interesting, a whole different language thrown in there. Make sure to write to me. Then the friend said, sure, I will call you when I arrive there. The writer, if you need something, please call me. I'll send it to you. The friend, okay, oh, I have to go. Take care. The writer, you too. So they talk about leaving, they talk about writing, they talk about having them said something. So it was a little more in depth.
And I'm going to read the native speaker's responses to question number 4. One that we categorize as a form 1, the shortest, just a terminal exchange. She wrote, hope you enjoy yourself and take care. That was it. And the more, this is a form 4, the most lengthy kind. The friend, well, you're going to have a great time. Her, the writer, yeah, I really am excited. you is the person who's writing. The writer, well, you're going to have a great time. The friend, yeah, I really am excited. you take a lot of pictures, and when you get back, we'll get together and you can tell me all about your trip. Her, okay, well, it's about that time. You, parentheses, give her a hug. Have a safe trip, and I'll see you when you get home. Okay, well, her, okay, bye, bye. So as you can see, it's very kind of, okay, this is how I see myself in that situation. She puts the hug in, you know, it's very kind of casual, and really she pictures herself and her friend in that situation. Versus the non-native speaker, where they did a good job, but it just doesn't have that quite same quality feel as the native speaker.
And that takes us to the conclusions, which we reached two, one for native speakers and one for non-native speakers. For native speakers, we said that in general, they use closures appropriate with the context of the situation. And with non-native speakers, and we kind of base our conclusions more on the open-ended questions than on the multiple choice questions, just because the results were not that different. And we thought that by writing it, it took them a little bit longer to come up with a form. So by the writing part, we concluded that in general, non-native speakers did not use the appropriate pragmatic form in the open-ended questions, especially those that completed the multiple choice open-ended questionnaire.
Right.
No,
multiple choice.
Yeah. And then relation to our findings to current second language acquisition research, we say we're in favor of the formal teaching of pragmatics, and we are suggesting some methods on the next transparency. And we said that non-native speakers seem to understand that closures exist, but do not have the language forms to perform them like native speakers. We feel that this seems to be evidence that the native language is interfering with the production of this pragmatic element, because maybe closing to something that happens in the culture, and they may be taking that form and putting it into English, and that's why it may not work. And in terms of this, we kind of describe their closings as more bookish, kind of the
right.
Thank you, see you, okay,
okay,
bye.
Bye.
And that's why it lacked some of the language that native speakers were using.
One, I should say one thing about the other conclusion about the interference of the native language. I know personally when I went to Italy, I knew that I just sounded kind of awkward. I just didn't really sound like a native speaker because I was missing some of those little like key words that can lead you into a sentence, kind of like when we say, okay, look, this is how I feel, or listen, you know, I don't feel well today. And I know that I'm like, God, what's that word? I need to just launch me into a more fluent sounding sentence. And finally, after like, I'm currently taking a conversation class right now, and finally the teacher taught us this word senti, which means like listen. And I'm telling you, I feel so much better speaking in Italian now because I have this kind of, I feel very cultural, very, you know, widely used word that can, you know, let me feel comfortable in my, you know, launching into the introduction of a sentence. So I felt that related pretty well to, you know, the non-native speakers and to the teaching of pragmatics in classes. Well, we'll come back to that in a minute. But right, so our study confirmed that the findings of Bardovi, Harlake, in terms of the four different closing forms identified by them, and that they found that non-native speakers frequently choose the shorter forms, and native speakers sometimes choose the longer forms or have access to that in their pragmatics, and also that there are these such four forms in the language, in the American language, or English language. Now, some suggested methods of instruction we kind of thought of for the classroom was making the non-native speakers aware of their own closures through appropriate and inappropriate role-playing. Like I said before, just if you become aware, okay, so there's a bunch of non-native speakers in the classroom, and the teacher says, okay, today we're going to, you know, learn about closures, and what they do is the teacher asks them to perform a role play in perhaps their native language and make them pay particular attention to the closing of the conversation, and then the students become aware of, oh, I say, you know, bye and then goodbye again, and this awareness helps them start thinking about how their pragmatic closure conversation can transfer into the non-native language. So then after the instructor does the native language closure, move on to a non-native language type of closure and say, okay, I would like you to role play in English how you would say goodbye to, you know, your friend. And just actually do these role plays, although people might think it's a little embarrassed at first, a little funny, but yeah, I think the awareness, and also Bardovi and Harlig spoke about it, really kind of affects people's cognitive awareness as to how they can become more comfortable. Also, listening to native speakers' closure in natural settings and just actually listening to the closure as opposed to the meaning of the conversation and just kind of listening to it in a coffee shop, with maybe an assignment for non-native speakers to just go to a coffee shop and just listen to people and how they're ending the conversation, make them more aware and perhaps help them in their fluidity of the language. One other thing.
Okay, I'm going to talk about how our project can be improved. In the instructions, it said, in this part you will write a dialogue for each of the scenarios. And as I said before, some people did not write dialogues. They just wrote a small kind of narrative form. So maybe phrasing it differently, like saying, please do this instead of you will do this. Just somehow suggest
we
that.
Said that that was an example. I wrote that. So it was an example of an unpragmatic. So I wrote, you will, and you think it should be, please.
It's not a huge thing. Okay, in terms of the format of the questions, we thought we could provide more informational context. The reason for that is we had one Russian subject who was a visiting professor who was a little bit upset with the way we phrased this. He didn't answer almost all the questions. He kept writing that we didn't have enough informational context. For example, on question two, the multiple choice, he says, maybe it would be D. And he said, as far as this is a business situation, I would use polite neutral. Again, it depends how frequently I visit this place and how long I've known this server. Depending on this, I would consider it to be a different option. So maybe for people who like it really specific, we could include that in the setup for each question.
He didn't attempt the open-ended questions, and he said that the topic and the context needs to be provided.
Which we thought we did, but maybe it wasn't specific enough.
I had like a 5-minute conversation with he seems to be, his line of research seems to be questionnaire. Thinking. Well thinking.
We thought maybe with the test we could alternate open-ended and multiple choice questions, or to do surveys with just all open-ended on one and all multiple choice on the other, because it did affect it when we did it one way or the other. Some people didn't write in dialogue form if they hadn't seen an example of it first, so maybe we take that into consideration.
And the other one we had that I just noticed is not there is using 3 different levels of proficiency, because in the article that we read, it says that even very proficient second language learners still have problems with pragmatic concepts, so we would like to see how they are really different.
Any questions?
Okay.
Did you take sex into account with your results?
No. Which might also be an interesting thing, because most of our native speakers were female, so that might account for the hugs and kisses goodbye. But,
I think so.
Yeah. But, so no, we didn't take sex into account. So that would be a good thing. That would be an interesting thing to do next time this experiment was done again, to look at the differences between the sexes.
Because intuitively, I have no basis for this, but I think that women probably draw things out more.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
definitely.
My father says, "Okay, you're okay, bye." Like,
right.
You know, but
right. Well, we did have like one response that was with the professor question. It was like, "Okay, office hours tomorrow. Okay, thanks, bye." And that was it. She was in from New York, so like maybe it's a New York thing. But but yeah, definitely we would. That was one thing we should improve upon in that project.
I was just. Choose short answers all across the board. It might have something to do with personality.
Yeah.
Because when I was answering like number 3 and 4,
mm-hmm.
I'm the kind of person that's just like, I'm done. You know.
In questionnaire or in setting?
Not in the actual setting, just in the questionnaire.
Oh,
form.
Yeah, that would be an idea as to, because at first you wanted to do like verbal, like actually naturalistic setting, listening to people and how they would close the close the conversation, but that, no, that's fairly difficult. Mm-hmm. So of course I think, you know, as relating back to your question earlier, oral, I think, information research will always give you a different answer than written, because people are in a hurry.
And I did the non-native speaker surveys, but and it was after a class, and they were really into it, and they wanted all of them to finish so I could say what was the purpose of it. They, you know, they were not in a hurry to finish it all. And actually, this, because when they saw the surveys, we were concerned that the Russian student didn't write anything, but he was the last one to turn it in, so it was not even lack of interest. He was really into it. So.
Yeah.
As far as whether they're talking face-to-face or telephone, because I know there's some cultures you don't say goodbye on the telephone, like Russians would don't say goodbye on the telephone, so they'll stand there for 4 hours and say goodbye to the train station.
No, that would be the multiple choice. No, because only one person did the long form for the multiple choice, and for the long form for question number two with the waitress. No,
they didn't vary within the individual.
No, that really didn't vary. It was more how, I think it was more focusing on how, you know, quickly they either could say get off or finish the conversation versus, you know, we'll make it a more drawn out thing. I don't think it would have to do
it. It seemed that their answers, especially to the multiple choice question, had more to do which part of the survey they did first. Because for the first question, three of the four people that did open-ended first answered A in the first question. So it was, and then it was the same way in terms of the dialogue in the open-ended. If they did the multiple choice first, they would write a dialogue in the second part. But if they were doing the open-ended, it was more of a narrative answer, and then they would see the multiple choice.
Which is why we want to alternate next time we do it.
But I think that sort of what people are feeling, what Marvin was talking about and related to Nathan and this one, and I'm trying to think, did we ever talk about doing a telephone? I mean, rather the longitudinal thing, some pragmatics, really, it doesn't seem that it takes on a paper pencil.
Right.
Now the other one, because we do invitations on a email at times, there's some reality
yeah.
to that situation.
Mm-hmm.
But closure, that the kind of closure you're looking for is, I think, very difficult to come by on a printed page.
Yeah.
And it's sort of refusals, apologies, too, although people do apologies. So I think that really, until you could get a little bit of information from an oral, some real data, it's going to be hard to do
yeah.
to imagine what it is. And I think that there's a lot of interference in terms of using a written task for some of these.